Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has met foreign ministers from Timor-Leste and Laos. Former Chairman Ma Ying-jeou of the Chinese Kuomintang Party has attended the ceremony honoring China's legendary Yellow Emperor in Shanxi Province. The World Bank says India is not creating enough jobs to sustain its young population. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has met Timor-Leste Minister of Foreign Affairs Bendito dos Santos Freitas. During the meeting in Guangxi, Wang Yi said bilateral cooperation will focus on four major areas determined by the leaders of both countries, including industrial revitalization, infrastructure development, food self-sufficiency, and improvement of livelihoods. Bendito Freitas said Timor-Leste looks forward to working with China to strengthen cooperation in economy, technology, agriculture, investment, and human resources. Earlier, the Chinese foreign minister held talks with his Lao counterpart, Solmaz Komesis. Wang Yi said China is ready to work with Laos to push for more tangible results in the building of the China-Laos community of shared future and fully support Laos as a rotating chair of ASEAN. For more, we're joined by Professor Song Xinrun. He is from the School of Asia Studies, Beijing Foreign Studies University. Thank you, Professor Song, for joining us.
Hello.
Now, Professor, during the meeting with Timor-Leste Minister of Foreign Affairs, Wang Yi said China was the first country to recognize and establish formal relations with Timor-Leste. He said China supports Timor-Leste to follow a development path that suits its own national conditions. Now, what's the lesson in China-Timor-Leste relations that are valuable for international relations?
The relationship between China and Timor-Leste has set a model for the development of relations between countries in the international community, especially between big and small countries' relationship. In the international community, countries of all sizes are equal, but should respect each other's national conditions and development paths, treat each other with respect, and do not interfere in each other's internal affairs, help and support each other, develop and prosper together, and benefit their people. Mm-hmm. Moreover, I believe that China-Timor-Leste will continue to inherit the fine tradition of mutual trust and women cooperation in the future. You implement the important consensus of the leaders of two countries and promote the continuous improvement of and upgrading of the comprehensive strategic partnership. Mm. The relationship between the countries will continue to serve as a model for the development of international relations between countries.
Mm. Well, Professor Song, help us understand more about the country. I mean, what are the main growth pillars of the economy in Timor-Leste?
Timor-Leste has abundant agricultural resources, including abundant agricultural products and vast agricultural land. Its agriculture is developing well. And Timor-Leste has beautiful natural scenery and a rich cultural heritage, providing unique conditions for the development of tourism industry. Mm. And I noticed that its tourism industry is also developing well. This country has a long and winding coastline with beautiful beaches and abundant marine resources. The natural landscape of Timor-Leste is very charming. This country has dense tropical rainforests, spectacular volcanoes and beautiful beaches. Mm. In addition, Timor-Leste also has unique wildlife resources such as elephants, crocodiles, and rare birds. In addition, and also Timor-Leste has abundant mineral resources, especially in oil and natural gas, including metal deposits such as gold, copper, and iron. Mm. With the popularization of the internet and the development of e-commerce has also shown great market potential in Timor-Leste.
Mm. Well, in light of all those resources and also all those developments, Professor, how can China and Timor Leste further collaborate under the Belt and Road Initiative?
But I think the two countries can strengthen cooperation in economy, technology, agriculture, investments, human resources, and other fields, and promote the implementation of more projects under the Belt and Road Initiative, so that the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries can achieve greater development. Wang Yi said in his meeting with the Timor-Leste counterpart that China is willing to establish an agriculture cooperation working group with the Timor-Leste to deepen local exchanges, participating in infrastructure construction in the Timor-Leste, and to further people-to-people exchanges and closely cooperating in the fields such as culture, education, vocational training, tourism, and sports. The two countries can create more practical cooperation highlights in the four major areas such as industrial revitalization, infrastructure development, food self-sufficiency, and people's livelihood improvement in the future.
Well, Wang Yi also met with Lao Minister of Foreign Affairs in Nanning. Now, Professor, help us understand, you know, what have been the noticeable achievements in China-Laos relations in the past few years?
The all-round cooperation between China-Laos in recent years has been very close and fruitful. The noticeable achievements in China-Laos relations is the opening of the China-Laos transnational railway and its great contribution to the cooperation between the two countries. We know that on December the 3rd, 2021, the China-Laos railway was fully opened. And it is the first railway fully opened in cooperation between China and ASEAN countries. As of March 27th this year, the number of international passenger trains of the China-Laos railway has exceeded 700. Attracting about 180,000 passengers from 87 countries and regions to travel across the border. I think this is the role of the international golden channel has become increasingly important, injecting new vitality into the economic and social development of China and Laos along the line. Moreover, after the completion of the China-Laos railway, the status of Laos in the region has been enhanced, which helps Laos transform from a landlocked country to a land-linked country. At the same time, the China-Laos railway has also facilitated the interconnection between China, Thailand, Vietnam, Myanmar, and other countries in this region, and promoted the development of regional economy.
Well, during the meetings, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said the Chinese economy is in transformation and China is focusing on developing new quality productive forces. Professor Song, what does this mean for other Asian economies who usually have very close trade and economic relations with China?
China is the largest economy in Asia and the second largest economy in the world. Its economy is full of vitality and an important engine of the global economic growth. China is developing new quality productive forces, expanding high-level opening up, and promoting Chinese path to modernization, which will become more prosperous and powerful. China's new development will provide new impetus for Laos and other Asian neighboring countries to jointly realize modernization, promote the cultivation of new quality productive forces in the region, and China will play a role model for other developing countries in Asia to achieve modernization, to promote the modernization process of Asia through high-quality development.
Well, if we take a look at the relations between China and Southeast Asian countries in particular, in general, Professor, in terms of economic development and global governance, so what are the common interests between China and these countries?
China is the world's largest, second largest economy and a permanent member of the UN Security Council. ASEAN is an important regional organization and the economies of ASEAN countries are very dynamic. And both China and ASEAN are important forces in maintaining world peace and promoting global economic development, playing important roles in global governance. Both China and ASEAN adhere to dialogue and cooperation, uphold the true multilateralism, uphold the international system with the UN as its core and the international order based on international law, advocate for democratization of international relations, and uphold equality for all countries regardless of size, strength, and wealth. China-ASEAN strengthen cooperation, promote global common development, promote global peace, and promote civilization exchange and mutual learning among countries around the world.
So all these will be the common aspirations between China and its neighboring countries, and also particularly countries in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And these will be the goals that we'll pursue together, you know, in their bilateral relationships, respectively. Thank you. We appreciate your time and your insight. That was Professor Song Qingren from the School of Asian Studies, Beijing Foreign Studies University. Coming up, Taiwan Youth Delegation led by Ma Ying-jeou attends a ceremony honoring the Yellow Emperor. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us.
France is about to present an Olympic opening ceremony like no other. That means it'll face challenges like no other, especially in terms of ensuring safety for more than 300,000 spectators and thousands of others, including the athletes. What would be the most difficult part of the unprecedented level of security work? Will it become a mission impossible for Paris? And how likely is it for the organizers to change the open-air ceremony plan? Check it out on this week's Chat Lounge, wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and on CGTN Radio.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Former Chairman Ma Ying-jeou of the Chinese Kuomintang Party has attended a ceremony honoring China's legendary ancestor Huang Di, or Yellow Emperor, in Shanxi province. Ma, together with a group of young people from Taiwan, are on a visit to the Chinese mainland. Earlier, the delegation traveled to some cities in Guangdong and will go to other cities, including Beijing, to reconnect to their Chinese roots. For more on this, I earlier had a conversation with Dr. Liu Kuangyu from the Institute of Taiwan Studies at Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. So how do you see the timing of the visit, especially against the background that Chinese people are having tomb-sweeping ceremonies these few days?
The timing of Manju's visit to the mainland is very appropriate. On the one hand, in terms of natural festivities, it coincides with the Qingming Festival, which is a common day for Chinese people on both sides of the straits to pay our tribute and commemorate our ancestors and pay our attention to the future of our lives. And so at this time of year, the family kinship is a common sentiment shared by all the Chinese people. And Ma Ying-jeou's visit coincides with this participation in the Huangdi Ancestor Memorial Ceremony on Qingming Festival, which also reminds compatriots on both sides of the straits, especially the Taiwanese public, that we are all the children of Yellow and Yan Emperor, and we are all worshipping our common ancestor in exactly the same way, which does carry as a cultural significance of two sides of the straits belonging to the same ethnic group, and that the two sides of the straits are one family.
Especially, what's the significance of this delegation by Ma Ying-jeou to attend the ceremony for, you know, the young people in the delegation?
Yes. We know that Mr. Ma visited the mainland last year. He returned to his hometown and commemorated his family's ancestor. And this time he's going to pay, he's paying homage to the Yellow Emperor, who is the common humanistic ancestor of the Chinese nation. So this is kind of a sublimation from a small family to a larger family, that is, from returning to the family's origin to this year, tracing the roots of the entire nation. And we all know that the Yan Huang Emperor is a humanistic ancestor of Chinese nation. They are the common source of our ethnic origin of cultural tradition and national identity of our Chinese people on both sides of the straits, and is also the important bond that maintains the greater unity of Chinese people at home and abroad, including Taiwan. And also we know that there is a high degree of recognition on this, of this idea, of this perspective on the island as well. There is a decades-long tradition of worshiping the Yellow Emperor in Taiwan, from their authorities to local people. And so we know that even the Generation Z in Taiwan growing up in the new century are not familiar with this, are not unfamiliar with this. So people have on the island have also been coming to the Chinese mainland for a long time to participate in Yanhuang ancestral worship activities. And therefore, the Yellow Emperor, like Mazu, like Guangong, like Confucius, are all worshipped by the Taiwanese people. There's a common belief and identity across the Taiwan Straits, which can continuously strengthen the concepts of cross-strait community, especially in the roots in the minds of the Taiwanese youth.
Mm. Well, on their first day of trip, the delegation visited tech companies, Dajiang and also Tencent. I mean, how do such visits help the two sides to understand each other?
Yeah, those three companies in this inner area are all well-known local enterprises in Shenzhen, which all belong to the head of industry in our country and even in the world. And Ma Ying-jeou chose to visit these highly influential enterprises. The first step, I think they can help open the students their horizon and harvest new discoveries with their own characteristics. As a president of the new quality of productivity, low altitude economy was written into the government work report this year, and this year's National People's Congress. And so we can see the DJI drones at outstanding representatives, low altitude economy track. In Taiwan, many people who love to fly drones are also keen to buy DJI drones. Mainland products can also be found in Taiwan's military drone supply chain. And similarly, Tencent is another shining business card of Shenzhen, and also a popular choice for many Taiwanese students to work and to do internships. We also know the TV series Flourish, Fanhua, which also hit in Taiwan some time ago, was also co-produced by Tencent, which means that the compatriots on both sides of the straits are we're sharing the same language and race, especially easy to empathize with each other. And as well as for BYD, the electric car represented by BYD is one of the three new things that have made a big splash in this year's. And in recent times, the DPP authorities have been obstructing the entire project, such as mainland drones and electric cars into the island, which has triggered huge backlash and controversy. So Shenzhen is not only a window for reform and opening up, but also a window for cross-strait exchanges and innovative development. So this might not be very familiar with the island's use. I think that is the significance of Ma Ying-jeou taking Shenzhen as their first landing stop.
Why do young people from Taiwan and the mainland need to know more about each other in particular?
Yes, more and more young people in Taiwan are deeply involved in cross-strait exchanges in recent years. The most important thing, I think, is to break down the false theories of lifestyles of the two sides of Taiwan Straits are completely different, or the two sides of the Straits are now one country, or the two sides of the Straits are even enemies, etc., which have been long been exaggerated or created by the green cap on camp on the island. And so we kind of weaken the Chinese genes on the use of the Taiwan island. On the other hand, this will help enhance their sense of belonging to and pride in the fact that both sides of the straits and we are all the sons and daughters of the Yellow Emperor of the same Chinese nation. And in the grand ancestor worship ceremony on the mainland, we can see that they can clearly perceive the philosophical propositions of who I am, where I came from, and where I'm going, and we'll have an emotional to rational perception of their own identity. And on the other hand, we'll give the young people on the island a more intuitive understanding of the sense of responsibility and mission of being a descendant of Chinese people, being the descendant of Yellow and Yan emperors. We know that both sides of the Taiwan Strait should, first is that the both of the Straits should take the responsibility to promoting and inheriting Chinese culture, not only to let to not be interrupted by interrupted in our generation, but also carry it forward and spread it, and especially in the face of erosion of cultural Taiwan independence and de-Chinization on the island.
Well, talking about that, Dr. Liu, how have the DPP party dealt with history education in Taiwan for the young people in the past few years or so? And what's the implication among Taiwan's younger generations?
Well, that is a systematic engineering political process for a long time, actually. We know that, let's take Taiwan, for example. Since coming to power, the Taiwan administration has repeatedly attempted to destroy and distort correct historical perception on the island by revising the secondary school language, Chinese language and history syllabuses, implanting erroneous historical concept in young students, and further severing the historical ties between the two sides of the Straits. As the saying goes, we know that destroying history before destroying one country, right? So the Thai authority, actually, they're attempting to subconsciously revise the historic, the general historical memory of the Taiwanese youth, and especially, and even the whole society, and reshape the national identity by distorting and weaving the historical facts. The first is to deepen the Chinese nation by introducing new curriculum. It's necessary to change the Han Chinese view of, they say that they're changing the Han Chinese view of history to the so-called Taiwan modern view of history, and place Chinese history in the context of so-called East Asian history, which is actually the Japanese history, and forcefully cutting the original deep and coherent structure of the Chinese history with political force, and taking and then breaking it down and processing it according to the Taiwanese independent consciousness. And the second is that the legalization of the undecided theory of the Chinese, of the Taiwan status, like for example, the new curriculum, the least the Carroll Declaration, the post-time proclamation, the Japanese instrument of subjugation, and all those historical, legal, international law documents that provides proofs that Taiwan belonged to China in the way of law, in the sense of international law. And also the new syllabus is fully devoted to so-called D China, D Sun Yixian, and D Chiang Kai-shek, and a lot of rhetoric like this, and it serves the pandering to Japan's view of history. And we all know that, as a matter of fact, since Li Tenghui and Chen Shui-bian, tampering with history syllabus has been the least costly, least risky, and most effective systematic project of cultural Taiwan independence, like I mentioned. Actually, Tsai Ing-wen, in the upgraded version of cultural Taiwan independence, the Taiwan administration, in addition to the basic doctrine of national secession, have also attempted to artificially create a so-called new Taiwan subjectivity and specialness, and in terms of race, language, and history, and hopefully to create a Taiwan Strait. I'm not a Taiwan is not a part of China. Taiwan is a country, so that sort of sense, and to artificially create a so-called Taiwanese nation, Taiwanese people, and so that they can serve their political end of pursuing the Taiwan independence.
That was Dr. Liu Kuangyu from the Institute of Taiwan Studies at Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Coming up, the World Bank says India is not creating enough jobs to sustain its young population. For more discussions, you can follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun. We'll be right back after a short break. We'll be right back.
Elaf Ellard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The World Bank says India and its neighbors are not creating enough jobs to sustain their young populations, even as the country enjoys the world's fastest economic growth. The bank predicts South Asia will be the world's fastest growing region over the next 2 years, with economies expanding by 6% in 2024 and 6.1% in 2025. India is expected to have grown 7.5% in this fiscal year to March, up from 7% a year earlier. But the bank also warns that the region's employment ratio is falling, potentially squandering its demographic dividend. India last year overtook China to become the world's most populous country. Now, for more on this, my colleague Zhao Ying joins us in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying, for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first up, explain to us what demographic dividend is and why it's important for countries like India and its neighbors.
Well, the demographic dividend refers to the economic benefits that arise when a country experiences a favorable age structure in its population, with a larger proportion of working-age individuals relative to dependents, which refers to children and the elderly. And to visualize it, we can imagine a scenario where there's a country's population's pyramid looks less like a pyramid and more like a bulging hourglass. Mm-hmm. And that bulge in the middle represents a large number of young people entering their working years. And this is the sweet spot economists call the demographic dividend. And for India and its South Asian neighbors, this demographic dividend represents a golden opportunity for accelerated growth because, first of all, a larger working age population translates to more hands contributing to the production of goods and services. And this increased productivity fuels economic growth and raises national income. And secondly, with a larger working population, there's a greater potential for household savings. Mm-hmm. And these savings can be channeled into investments that create jobs, improve infrastructure, and fuel further economic development. Furthermore, young people often bring fresh ideas, a willingness to take risks, and openness to new technologies. So this can lead to a surge in innovation and technological advancements. And additionally, a larger working population translates to a broader tax base, and this increased revenue allows the government to invest in crucial areas like education, healthcare, infrastructure, which in turn fosters a more skilled workforce and a better overall environment for businesses to thrive. So if India and its neighbors can successfully harness this demographic dividend by creating enough jobs and opportunities for the young population, it can lead to a period of rapid economic expansion. But of course, proactive policies and investment are also needed to fully realize this potential.
Mm. So the World Bank suggests there's a potential of, squandering this demographic dividend. I mean, how is that happening and what could be the consequences?
Yes, according to the World Bank, job creation in South Asian economies obviously is not keeping pace with the rise in the working age population. Mm-hmm. The employment ratio for South Asia was 59% last year, compared with 70% in other emerging markets. And during the period between 2000 and 2023, employment grew 1.7% a year, while the working age population expanded 1.9% a year. So in absolute terms, the region created an average of 10 million jobs a year, while the working age population was growing by an average of 19 million a year. Mm. So the issue of joblessness is particularly serious in India, with the youth unemployment rate being 45.4% in 2023. And the consequences can be grave because a large young population becomes a burden rather than a boon for the economy. Mm. And the unmet desires of these workers who are actually more educated and more indebted than ever, they can become a volatile force for the society. For example, last summer, some young men set fire to trains as they were furious about a plan that could eliminate jobs in the armed forces. And there can also be an immense waste of human potential because, you know, although some young workers, they are not out of employment completely, they are doing some unfulfilling and unproductive work. But many of them actually have received a very good education and they can create more value if put in the right place.
Indeed. So the region is now the fastest growing region. Then why is South Asia and India particularly facing challenges, you know, in creating jobs for its young population?
Well, take the situation in India, for example. Actually, India's economic growth is largely being fueled by sectors like information technology and financial services, which don't need to employ lots of people. So the growth has come from sectors that are not job intensive. And manufacturing's contribution to India's GDP has fallen from around 17% 2 decades ago to only 13% in 2022, according to the World Bank. And also notably, during the COVID period, many workers are streaming from cities back to villages in rural India. So they are actually going back to agriculture, which can be a challenge to the country's plan to transform into an industrial nation. So one issue is the gap between the skills demanded by employers and those possessed by job seekers. There's a serious mismatch there because many young people want to go to government jobs for stability, but the vacancies are very limited and the competition is fierce. It's reported that there can be 1,800 applicants vying for a single position. And this leads to a high unemployment rate among educated youth. And the private sector, particularly in manufacturing and services, isn't expanding fast enough to absorb the growing workforce. And this keeps many young people stuck in some low-paying informal jobs or go back to agriculture. And actually, a large portion of South Asia's workforce is employed in the informal sector, which is characterized by low productivity and limited job security. And this makes it difficult for young people to find stable and well-paid jobs. But on the other hand, some companies, they are struggling to find skilled workers to meet the demands of their businesses. So this shortage of suitable laborers make them consider automation, which could further reduce job opportunities for the workforce. So I guess the key is to address this mismatch between employers and workers. Perhaps more vocational trainings to make the graduates more prepared for the demands of the job market.
I think the mismatch is really big here. Well, Zhang Ying, the report also highlights, you know, how the low female employment ratio in India. Why is that?
Yes, that's another serious challenge because female employment ratios in many South Asian countries, including India, are among the lowest in the world. From 2021, fewer than one in five Indian women work formally, and that's roughly in line with Afghanistan's before 2021 Taliban takeover. And as female labor participation rate has been in decline, actually it declined from 32% in 2005 to 19% in 2021, which means as the country develops, women are actually dropping out of the workforce. And this is happening among rich and poor women in urban and rural areas across social class, religion, and age groups. One reason is that there is this cultural belief that see women as the primary caregiver. So, but also because there is not enough jobs in the market. So the families may see more benefit in taking care of the home or taking care of the children instead of working in some low-paid sectors.
Well, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has ambitious goals for India's development, but the World Bank said these goals might be out of reach without significant reforms. Zhao Ying, briefly, what are some of the key reforms needed to unlock India's potential?
Well, first, of course, creating more jobs is crucial. It needs to revive the manufacturing sector to create more opportunities for the growing workforce. This means attracting investment, streamlining regulations, and most importantly, ensuring young people have the skills that factories need. But jobs are not the only piece of the puzzle because infrastructure, for example, is crucial for connecting businesses and markets. So India can prioritize projects like improving transportation networks, reliable power grids, and of course, digital infrastructure as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it should give up some protectionist policies to attract more foreign investment and create a healthy business environment.
Mm. Well, thank you, Zhao Ying, for helping understand this Indian population problem. That was my colleague Zhao Ying. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievsky Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy and management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. A recent survey finds China has emerged slightly ahead of the United States as a preferred choice among Southeast Asian nations if countries were forced to choose between the two major powers. The survey titled The State of Southeast Asia is conducted annually by Singapore-based Yusuf Ishak Institute. This year's survey finds that 50.5% of respondents preferred China if the region were forced to align itself in a major country rivalry. The United States dropped from 61.1% in the previous year to 49.5%. Now, for more on this, we're joined by Professor Wang Zhengxu from the School of Public Administration, Zhejiang University. Thank you, Professor Wang. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Mm. Now, Professor, first of all, help us understand, you know, how public opinion in Southeast Asia view this particular survey and the think tank.
Yes, this acronym ICES, Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, is probably one of the most reputable, if not the most reputable, center or Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in the world. It is one top think tank in Singapore. So it has a large number of very high quality scholars and some very important research programs. So it is quite a good service they have done to academic and the public conducting this annual public opinion survey. Mm. So I actually like to hear what they find from the data they collected.
Mm. Well, I have said earlier in the news that now China has edged past the United States to become the prevailing choice if the region were forced, you know, to choose to align itself in the ongoing U.S.-China rivalry. The U.S. as a choice has dropped from 61.1% in 2023 to this year's 49.5%. That's quite something. And close to half of the respondents, about 46.8%, believe that ASEAN should enhance its resilience and unity to fend off pressures from, you know, these two major powers. Professor, how do you see the reason or the background behind, you know, such changes among ASEAN residents regarding their views on China and the United States?
Well, I think, first of all, it is unfortunate that countries here feel that they have to make a choice.
Indeed.
I think they would rather have both China and the United States and any other global players to play a positive role in this region and in global affairs. So they would rather not make a choice. But I think the countries in the region increasingly feel that it is actually the United States that is pushing these countries to take a side. Mm-hmm. And they keep saying to the U.S. that, no, don't make us make the don't make us to make the choice. We actually would like to have both of you and any other interesting players to be with us. But the fact that this year, overall, more people choose China, that say quite a lot of things. One, I think it just shows the China's relation with these countries, the economic and culture exchanges and ties with these countries do make people in this country feel that China is more positive, is constructive. China is a party that that people can trust.
Mm.
Where foreign policy in the United States for the last few years have seen some, people say withdrawal, tendency of withdrawing from providing enough support to countries in the region. And people are feeling more uneasy about the United States' role in the region. So overall, it does show the global power game, power play is something the United States needs to be to think of.
Well, what you said reminds me of, the Malaysian leader, Anwar, what he said during a meeting, between ASEAN and Australia, where he said that ASEAN countries should not be forced to, make a choice between China and the United States. But going back to ASEAN itself, in the survey, Singapore and Indonesia, two original ASEAN founding members, are acknowledged as having the biggest contributions to ASEAN's long-term development and progress. Singapore holds 66%, whereas Indonesia holds 41.5% of the votes for regional leadership. Help us understand more, Professor, about the leadership roles that these two members are playing within ASEAN.
Well, it is interesting that you have the most populous country and the smallest country in terms of population, Singapore, that are ranked high among ASEAN people as the providing leadership for the organization, for the region. Indonesia has the largest population. It has the largest economy, I believe. And historically, enjoy a very close tie with the United States. So it is an important strategic player in the region. Singapore, despite its size, its economy is the most advanced one in the region, and one of the most advanced in the world. So in many ways, Singapore is treated as among the highly developed countries of the whole world, and its leadership, it has had very strong domestic leadership from Lee Kuan Yew's time, and the leadership is very good at devising a coherent vision for the country and working with other ASEAN countries to develop a coherent plan or vision for the whole organization.
Mm.
And I think the leadership, the leaders of Singapore, they understand the ASEAN regions very well. They understand different countries' culture and different countries' strategic thinking, foreign policy thinking. And they also enjoy good relation with both China and the United States,
right,
and also the European countries. So that way, I think Singapore does play a lot of what you can call intellectual leadership to the organization.
Mm.
It provides a lot of, in Chinese, you can say a lot of spirit instead of material strength. You provide a lot of spiritual strength to the organization and to the regional countries.
Mm. Briefly, Professor, in light of all of what we have discussed, do you think China should adjust its ASEAN policies, or should it just continue with what it has already had?
Well, there are always things to keep doing and keep doing it well.
Mm.
I think for the last 20 years, China has had very good relation with ASEAN countries, with the region. China plays a very positive role in the region, both for regional peace and probably more importantly, for countries to enjoy economic opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So now with the In 2001, the first free trade agreement between ASEAN and China was signed. And then now, several years ago, this RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, went into effect. And also China's Belt and Road Initiative has a lot of programs in the region. So all these, I think, are very positive contribution China introduced to the region. The people-to-people exchange is also very intensive. So all this, you know, for thousands of years, China have been in good relation with this region. So I think there's no reason that people should try to discredit China's role in the region, and China should do whatever it can to help the region, to work together with the region.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. That was Professor Wang Zhengxu from the School of Public Administrations at Zhejiang University.
As one of CGTN Radio's most popular programs, World Today provides listeners with a strong mix of international news and business. It delivers in-depth analysis of current affairs and one-on-one interviews, bringing you the stories behind the news, not just what's happening, but why.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Saudi Arabia's tourism ministry said the country's tourism industry celebrated a significant milestone by welcoming 100 million tourists in 2023. This means the country has achieved the government target 7 years ahead of the timeline set by Vision 2030. Saudi officials said the country is now aiming to host 150 million tourists by 2030. The World Tourism Organization said this milestone in Saudi Arabia underscores the country's emergence as a global tourism powerhouse, adding that it highlights Saudi Arabia's leading role in the economic diversification and sustainable development of global tourism. For more on this, we're joined by Aina Tangen, Senior Fellow at the Taihe Institute. Thank you, Aina, for joining us again.
Always a pleasure.
Now, Aina, how do you see the factors that have contributed to Saudi Arabia's success in tourism?
Well, there's a number of things. First off, Saudi has been very, very aggressive in terms of providing entertainment. I mean, they've made a huge strike in terms of golf. Obviously, football, they're planning to hold the next World Cup as soon as they can get one. And in addition to that, they also have Hajj. I mean, it's the center of the world. And there are other religious places there where Ummah, where people have to go. Your life is not complete as a Muslim until you go there. So that's one part of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at Indonesia. They have been expanding the number of Indonesians going there, not just because of the holy sites, but also for leisure and experiential travel. 7.5 million Indians went there last year, and they're looking to double that. There's a large Indian diaspora. 34 properties were opened, but one hotel chain, the same one that owns the Taj Mahal, and they signed up 50 more. So it's a burgeoning market, and it's being serviced by a new airline. It is opening up. They're buying a lot of planes. So it's all part of one plan. It's very akin to what China does in having a comprehensive plan to go at this.
Well, you heard me earlier. You know, the Saudis are quite ambitious about their goal by 2030. They aim to host 150 million tourists in that year. How do you see the prospect of that?
Well, you know, you never know exactly. I mean, there can always be, these black swan events. No one was anticipating that. The kind of troubles that we've seen in Gaza, Ukraine, and other places. If the war expands in the Middle East, obviously that is not going to happen. I'm not saying it'll disappear. I mean, the holy sites will be there, but people will be looking for a place that is more peaceful to go. As opposed to somewhere where there's a war being fought next door. but barring that, I mean, they have all the software and the hardware they need. They're very, very focused on this. I've talked to people at the the Saudi investment and also diplomatic corps, and they all on message about how they're going to get this done.
Well, Aina, officials from Saudi Tourism Authority revealed in November last year, they told Chinese press that Saudi Arabia plans to become a top tourist destination, attracting 5 million Chinese tourists by 2030. I mean, what's your estimation of that? What are the conditions, that could help these tourism exchanges?
Well, things have liberalized quite a bit in Saudi Arabia. There was a time when, you had religious police going around, and they were quite severe. They didn't like what they thought was immodest dress and things like this. That has really kind of died down. There's a much more openness there. That makes it much easier for people to get around. There's, as I said, a tremendous amount of attractions. People think of Saudi Arabia as this huge desert. That is not true. You go to the coastlines and you'll see incredible, visages, green, everything like that. All the things you don't imagine about Saudi Arabia, but it's there. And as I said, there are so many different things to go there. And especially during times when it's very cold in China, there's wonderful things to do. And within China, there's this real sense of adventure tourism. They just don't want to get on a bus and take some pictures anymore. They want to have an experience, and Saudi Arabia can offer that.
Briefly, Aina, how does tourism industry, boost the resilience of the Saudi economy?
Well, it's an alternative. The 2030 plan was all about trying to figure out how to wean itself away from this the reliance on oil and gas. So they're very serious about this stuff. They're building new cities and things like that. Obviously, funding is an issue. They have a lot of money. They've announced a huge gold strike. And they, in addition to that, they have tremendous resources that have not been developed. But they don't want to be a country, subject to the resource curse, e.g. They want to develop their industries. They're not only doing the tourism for people to come and have an experience. They also want people to come and then think about settling there, especially people who are in high tech, who are coming up with innovative products, ideas, services. This is something very, very much on their dashboard in terms of how they intend to drive their economy, because they do think it's about human resources.
Thank you, Aina. Always appreciate your time and insight. That was Aina Tangen, Senior Fellow at the Taihe Institute. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. A quick recap of the headlines. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met foreign ministers from Timor-Leste and Laos. Former Chairman Ma Ying-jeou of the Chinese Kuomintang Party has attended a ceremony honoring China's legendary Yellow Emperor in Shanxi Province. The World Bank says India is not creating enough jobs to sustain its young population. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. For further discussions, follow us on the X platform at CGTN Radio. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.